want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
All the world over, so easy to see. People everywhere just wanna be free. Listen, people, listen, that's the way it should be. Deep in the valley, people got to be free.
Thanks for downloading the very latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today we're going to talk about solitary confinement.
You should see. What a lovely, lovely world this could be. Everyone learned how to live together.
My buddy Keb Moe opens the podcast today. And as always, I want to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Folks like Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, Michelle Pasco, I know she's in Sacramento, Janet Price, and Grant Gibson up in Portland, Oregon. Sarah Shord spent more than 400 days in solitary confinement in Iran. And it's an experience that's changed her life. She has co-edited a powerful new book called Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement. And Americans are waking up about this scourge and the heavy price it extracts from people who are subjected to this brutal kind of punishment. I think you'll find this very enlightening, and I want to thank Sarah Shord for coming to the Secret Studio and putting up with my barky dog as we conducted this conversation.
I'll be what I am, a solitary man, solitary man.
Americans are becoming much more aware of barbaric practices that we utilize in domestic prisons at the state and federal level. It's called solitary confinement, and Johnny Cash intoned it there with the old Neil Diamond song. With me in the secret studio today is Sarah Shord. She, together with James Ridgway and Gene Casella, have edited a new book called Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement. Sarah, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's awesome to be here, Peter.
Unfortunately, you know too much about this subject, don't you?
I do.
Yeah. You spent more than 400 days in solitary in Iran.
Yeah, it's been about 5 years now since I got out, a little more than 5 years. So it feels like a chapter, if not two chapters ago in my life. I've had a lot of time to digest it and moved on considerably, but it's always with me.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll never really leave it behind, do you think?
No. I like to think that I've been able to transform a lot of that pain into the work that I'm doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel that many people who are innocent and who wind up in prison use that experience for a kind of inner change and inner meditation. And many come out determined to try to do something to address the pain and suffering that they experienced and prevent it from happening to others. And that's what I see in at least your public life since you returned to the U.S.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know what other... For me personally, that wasn't really a choice. I mean, it is a choice. Mm-hmm. Actually, I tell myself that every day, that I don't have to do this work, that I do this, that it's an honor and a privilege to be able to do this work. But at any time, I can turn away and decide that I want to focus on something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
That gives me a sense of control and autonomy around it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard for me to imagine another path because this is kind of who I've always been.
Yeah. Did you ever imagine that you'd be an activist and that you would take on the issues of the incarcerated?
I was well aware of how completely broken and messed up our system of mass incarceration is before I moved to the Middle East and before I was imprisoned in Iran. But it wasn't something I could access. Like so many people, it hadn't happened to anyone that I knew directly. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like an impossible problem that just, you know, was how do you even begin?
Right. Yeah. And you don't feel powerless now, though, do you? In confronting this? I mean, it's a monstrous issue and a big bureaucracy and, you know, corrections machine that you have to confront.
Yeah. No, powerless is not the word I would use. I do get overwhelmed and I do get sad. But I also get incredibly excited and inspired by the connections that I've been able to make with people inside. Mm-hmm. And the way that really I've been able to penetrate the system. It feels empowering to be able to go into it. I've been in now over 15 different prisons around the country. Mm-hmm. To go inside and to connect with people despite all the efforts to silence them and disappear them and to, you know, to bring their stories out. And this book is a huge moment for me.
Yeah. Now, Sarah, just to remind people, it was July 31st of 2009 that you and the man who's now your husband, Shane Bauer, and your mutual friend Joshua Fatal were hiking along the Iraqi-Iranian border, and you were treated like spies. The Iranians captured you, and there was a huge publicity campaign that they launched. Certainly, you didn't see it at the time. But tell us about your experiences of being taken into custody. And I believe you were held at the Evin prison, right? The dreaded, it's kind of the equivalent of Alcatraz, at least image-wise, in that part of the world. Tell us what you felt at that time and your sense of hope and sense of perhaps you will never get out of here.
Well, I mean, spies at Evin prison, like an actual American spy in Iran is sentenced to death and executed by hanging. So we were never actually treated by like spies per se because they always knew that we weren't.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when we were captured at the border, I didn't speak a word of Farsi. I didn't have any documents forged. I was completely unprepared. And if we had walked into Iran from that tourist site, we would have been arrested in minutes.
And you had forgotten to bring your CIA American Express card, right?
Right. But I mean, this question is so big and it's always so hard to answer, even after years and years of trying, because a year in solitary confinement is such an amazingly, interminably, inexpressibly long time. And people that I regularly correspond with and have visited now have been in from anywhere to 3 to 27 years.
Mm-hmm.
In very similar conditions to what I was subjected to. But when I talk about something like hope, is that what you asked me about, is hope?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's that balance. You have to keep some hope that
sure.
You will ultimately be released.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's a very depressing cycle where hopelessness can certainly outweigh any aspirations you have.
Well, I never felt hopeless because to me, hopeless would mean that I was ready to take my own life, and I never considered doing that. I knew I could never give up because I knew that my mother was fighting on the outside. I
mm-hmm.
knew that my family was fighting. All of my friends were fighting, and I knew that my husband and friend were fighting alongside me. So giving up was never something I considered as an option.
Mm-hmm.
But I did go through periods where I didn't eat for days at a time. I didn't move. I prayed that I would just disappear, that somehow I would wake up and realize that it was a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Or that it all would just go away somehow. That,
mm-hmm.
I went through periods of rage where I screamed and beat at the walls until my knuckles were bloody. Extreme emotions, of all kinds. And it wasn't until I realized that I might actually lose my mind that I became incredibly disciplined. And you hear this from a lot of prisoners. I had a daily regime, where every single minute was filled with activity, from mostly exercise to meditation, to prayer, to various memorization activities, and singing and dancing. I had a something to do every moment of the day because mm-hmm. I couldn't let my mind go there to that hopeless place.
Yeah. And when you say singing and dancing, you didn't have any radio or music. You had to do that.
Every song I could remember, and I made up the lyrics.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. My favorite song to sing was Gracias a la Vida by the Mercedes Sosa version.
Mm-hmm.
I would wake up every morning and sing it at the top of my lungs. The guards would come in and tell me to be quiet, and I would sing it louder.
Mm-hmm. And were there any episodes of physical abuse or torture?
I was in solitary confinement for 410 days, mm-hmm. and the UN Special Rapporteur says that 2 weeks can cause permanent brain damage and can constitute torture.
Mm-hmm.
So I was tortured psychologically the entire time.
And Sarah, what kind of communication did they permit with your colleagues, your now husband, Shane, and with the friend who was there with you?
With Shane and Josh?
Yeah, Josh.
Eventually, after a few months, when they really thought that I was in danger of harming myself, they let me have periods with them in mm-hmm. the open air mm-hmm. room, which at first it was half an hour a week and we would be blindfolded. And then eventually it was an hour a day at the end.
Mm.
Even an hour a day still meant that I was in alone 23 hours a day, which under international law is solitary confinement.
Yeah.
But of course it made a world of difference and it improved my condition, in a huge, huge way.
Mm-hmm.
It was also incredibly traumatic to be torn apart again and again and again.
Yeah.
And I had to deal with really, at the time I was really ashamed of a lot of the feelings that I was obsessed with, of jealousy that they could be together, that
mm-hmm.
they could play chess together, that they could give each other shoulder rubs, that they could say good morning, and that I had to fight against this feeling that I was being singled out, that somehow I was being punished in a way that was even more unfair than our incarceration in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And you were released before Josh and Shane. How did they explain that to you? And, you know, what was your experience of that?
There was no explanation. There was no preparation for it. I was just taken out of my cell and told that I was going to meet with the Omani envoy. The Omani government negotiated our release, and
mm-hmm.
I went on to work with them for the next year afterwards. I told them I wouldn't leave without Shane and Josh, and I refused to sign the paperwork. And then I told them that I wasn't going anywhere. And they finally brought my lawyer in. It was the first time I was able to meet my lawyer. And my lawyer told me that my family and everyone wanted me to leave, and that he advised me that I was going to go whether I wanted to or not. Mm. So
that must have been wrenching.
Yeah, it was horrible.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible, and it continued to be horrible for the whole next year. But it was horrible in a different way because I had some kind of power and agency, and that just flooded my veins with a joy that I can't describe to have that back.
And how much solitary time did Shane and Josh receive?
The first 3 months they were in solitary during interrogation, and then they were put together in very extremely isolated confinement for
mm-hmm.
the next 2 years.
Now, recently, Sarah, we've seen some high-profile people who were in solitary released. Jason Rezaian, the Washington Post journalist who claims our backyard here, Marin County, as his home. He was released at the end of October after a lengthy ordeal, and he spent quite a bit of time in solitary. Did you follow that? I think I know the answer, but what was your reaction just to his experience, the prolonged negotiations, and his ultimate release?
Oh, that was just incredible. With Jason and Amir, all of the hostages being released at the same time, although there's still reportedly two American hostages.
Father and son, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know too much about their case, to be honest, yet, but I don't think any of us do. But, of course, I followed Jason and Amir very, very closely. It's a revolving door. As soon as Shane and Josh got out, they picked up Amir just weeks before. And then Jason was next. And I predicted that he was going to get out. I wrote an article saying all the signs are there. It's lining up. As soon as the sanctions are lifted, they're going to let them go. But there's always a possibility that something can go wrong and that won't happen. So it's not until the last minute that you actually know. And it was like reliving it in a way I could feel it more with this distance. I was just so incredibly happy for them.
Yeah. And also we saw Albert Woodfox released from Angola in Louisiana.
Yes.
Where he spent over 40 years
Incredible.
In solitary.
Incredible man.
Yeah.
I've been in touch with him as well.
Have you?
Yeah. He's he's so, you know, there's no words. He just didn't know if it was ever going to happen.
Right. Well, I mean, these experiences offer some release and relief, but we know that thousands of mostly men are incarcerated in solitary confinement. California continues to operate the SHU, the SHU Security Housing Unit, most infamously at Pelican Bay, up along the coast near the Oregon border. But there are SHUs in other, you know, there are 34 institutions in the California system, and a number of them have these solitary systems. And they become more high-tech with a touch-free experience where the guards never really have any contact with the inmates who are in solitary. You know, simply the loneliness is something that is hard for me to even conceptualize, Sarah, to imagine, to be, you know, denied any tactile experience, even just shaking hands or a pat on the back for 40 years has got to leave you feeling less than human.
Yeah, we're not wired for it. People do adapt, maybe outwardly. They appear to be okay, some of them. Others don't. Others just completely lose any semblance of sanity and become obsessive compulsive. There are people that clean their cells 22 hours a day for years at a time in their bodies. There are other people that get so detached that they, you know, they think they're okay. And it's really not until you're out that you realize that you've been changed irrevocably, mm-hmm. that something profoundly violating has been done to you.
Well, and your book is a collection of essays, some by people who have experienced solitary confinement, some by like psychiatrist Terry Coopers, who has worked with individuals in solitary and studied the psychological, psychiatric impact on them. And it's really touching. I want to read just a passage here from Joseph Dole. He says, "What makes prison so hard is having ambitions, dreams, and goals, and wanting to do right and accomplish positive things. Prison is conducive to none of these. It's so much easier not to care about life, not learn, not grow intellectually, not mature. It's easier to just hate. Hate life, hate people, hate yourself. Striving to do something with your life, especially under these conditions, makes every day that much harder. It's always easiest to destroy or ignore, hardest to care and build up yourself, other people, society, etc. It's easier for people to give up on themselves, their children, others. It's why society finds it so easy to automatically demonize and write off anyone convicted or even charged with a crime without even knowing for certain whether he or she is guilty." And this is another aspect that I think is really important, that those who are forced to submit to solitary confinement have these very conflicted feelings. They know that they have been declared disposable, yet they're still human beings, many of whom who have productive contacts with other human beings outside the prison system. And yet being consigned to solitary leaves them with this sense that there's no upside. There's no reason to try to improve yourself, to try to get better, because the only way out of the SHU is to rat on somebody else. And that's how many people wind up in the SHU to begin with. And so it's this excruciating, you know, cycle of catch-22. And the dehumanizing impact of it is something that this book brings out in a very rich and painful way.
Mm, yeah. Well, I mean, that actually has changed in California, the snitch or die policy. Up until recently, people could be held in solitary confinement indefinitely, and the only way they can get out is to snitch on someone else, which would mean most likely death to them in the future because they'd get killed in revenge.
And can I pause just to insert this point about how ridiculous it is to imagine that somebody who's been in solitary for 10, 20, or 30 years has any information on another inmate that could be useful. I mean, it's just irrational.
Right. And that's the reason that CDCR was forced to settle on this recent case. So people, the shoe still exists. Solitary confinement is still very much alive in this state and, of course, across the country. But a lot of people have been let out, but they still haven't and have no plans. I talked directly to CDCR spokesperson in an article that I did on the settlement. They have no plans to shut down any units. So the fear is they're letting out these old school guys who have been in for decades that are no threat to anyone and opening up the space for younger people fresh off the streets that may actually have that intelligence that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So they're reshuffling the deck, but solitary confinement is still alive and going strong.
Uzair Paracha, if I'm pronouncing the name correctly, writes, there were absolutely no educational opportunities for prisoners in the unit. I myself had just finished my master's, but I wanted to get some typing lessons to improve my speed. They didn't trust me with any type of keyboard. Another prisoner wanted to brush up on his geometry, but they didn't trust him with even a photocopy of a ruler. Now, how can you weaponize a piece of paper that has a ruler, you know, photocopied onto it?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's a completely irrational system of trying to achieve total control, which, as we know, total control is an impossible thing. I mean, I hope we know that. I know that. Mm-hmm. Human beings will always find a way around it. They'll always find a way to reach out to each other and make contact. I mean, the stories of how prisoners reach out to each other in solitary confinement in this book are phenomenal. And I lived it myself. I mean, we found ways to pass notes to each other when I was in prison. I would tuck it inside a used tampon and leave that in the bathroom trash and whisper at night to a woman down the hall so that we could just tell each other we loved each other and give each other hope. Human beings will always find a way to break this kind of irrational, arbitrary control. And a lot of the guards know this. I mean, a lot of guards they've been in this for generations and they think that this is keeping them safe because that's what they've been taught, but a lot of them know better. It's only making the prisons more violent, more volatile. I traveled to a prison, William Blake, who has an essay in this anthology, A Sentence Worse Than Death. I traveled to meet him. He's been in for 27 years, and you go on a bus from New York City all night long. Families have their children wrapped up in a mountain of blankets because it's freezing cold outside. The bus broke down twice on the way. And we get to this little town, this idyllic little, upstate New York town with snow-capped church steeples. And then you see the prison, and we got in, and we went into the solitary confinement unit, and it's a gulag. I mean, it is the most terrifying nightmare right in the backyard of so many Americans' lives that I don't think they have the faintest idea it exists, and it's being done in their name, under the pretense of protecting them and keeping them safe. But the vast majority of people in solitary confinement will be released into our streets with no transition, no services, no safety net on the outside. So they self-medicate with alcohol and drugs. They go back to crime. They don't have any skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's a self-perpetuating cycle, and it's madness.
Yeah.
That same prison, when I was meeting with Billy, and you go into this room and he's in a small cage, and the cages are actually better than the thick glass that when you visit someone at Pelican Bay, because you can actually shake hands and I can pass him stuff from the vending machine.
Right. The terminology is a contact or non-contact visit.
Right.
And non-contact, you sit in a booth and talk on the phone through plexiglass.
Mm-hmm. And the cages are literally cages. And when he's gesticulating, because Billy is full of spit and fire and energy, he's a brilliant talented writer. I can read something from his essay if you'd like.
Please, yeah.
The guards kind of sauntered up, and Billy had told them that I was coming, and they'd kind of knew about my story from the news and wanted to meet me. And I said to the guard, do you, you know, this guy has been kept in a box longer than you've been alive, 27 years. The guard was 25.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, do you think this is the right thing to do? Do you believe in this? And he said, if I told you what I thought about this, I'd be out of a job.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of these guards, they see it up close and personal. They know much better than the average person.
Right. Well, the guards are in prison, too. You know, they get to leave every night. But, you know, they're highly restricted. They can't express opinions.
They're literally in prison.
Yeah, they can't be human.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I've been visiting San Quentin for over 30 years, and I've met some really nice guards who are human beings who will tell you, oh, yeah, I knew this prisoner because we went to high school together 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And others are just total dicks, and they work at it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no one can be a guard without getting hardened and losing some of their own humanity.
Yeah.
It's a terrifying thing to be. It's a terrifying place to live your life. So this is something from William Blake's essay, A Sentence Worse Than Death, which went viral and he won an award for. I've experienced times so difficult and felt boredom and loneliness to such a degree that it seemed to be a physical thing inside, so thick it felt like it was choking me, trying to squeeze the sanity from my mind, the spirit from my soul, and the life from my body.
Yeah.
He's a talented writer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing that we didn't expect to find is just how powerful and unique, you know, these idiosyncratic voices. I think that New Press, when we first told them about this anthology, they were concerned that a lot of these stories would be similar,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, same conditions. It could get a little repetitive, but I think hopefully you can attest to my saying that it's anything but that.
The voices are distinct, and the experiences cover, you know, a wide range of behaviors and responses. And Sarah, I wanted to share a little bit with you. I've been corresponding for about 5 years now with a man named James Anderson, who is on death row down the road here at San Quentin. And he's been there since 1980, 36 years. And as I got to know him better, I found out that he and I grew up a couple of miles apart in Cincinnati. We were born 6 months apart. He went to a public high school, and my parents sent me to a private school. And, well, you know, our paths went in very different directions. But James is a very bright and articulate guy, and recently he had an altercation with a guard on his cell block, was accused of having a cell phone, and accused of flushing that cell phone down the toilet as the guard questioned him. I believe James. He says he didn't have a phone, and they came into his cell and they found some electrical parts. He's a fix-it guy, and they found a charger for a cell phone. And so that was sufficient evidence for them to throw him in the hole. And he was supposed to be released earlier this week. I haven't heard from him yet, so it's possible he has not. But one of the points that he made was about the guards. He said, there are numerous corrections officers assigned to positions on death row who have psychological or psychiatric impairments, bipolar, depression, anxiety, etc. And, you know, he's a pretty sharp observer, I think, of human behavior. And this is one of the issues that we never really hear much about, and that is the demeanor of the guards and the latitude that they have under the management of a correctional institution to break the rules in order to brush back an individual prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole code of silence and this loyalty among guards that they close ranks, regardless of how preposterous the cover story may be. They'll close ranks and all say, oh, yeah, that's how it happened. That's how it happened. And we see that in the, highly controversial police shooting cases around the country where the officers will support a concocted story that nobody can believe. And they often get away with it because, after all, they've got the badge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, there's absolutely no oversight to these decisions being made to put someone in the hole. And once you're in there, it's so easy for guards to pile on one infraction after another. They can make it up, or they can, I mean, all you have to do is look at them wrong and they can say insubordination or,
right.
And add on more and more time, and they can keep you there forever if they want to.
Mm-hmm. So James writes, once a prisoner is moved to the adjustment center, as they call it at San Quentin, and in parentheses, he refers to it as Little Gitmo, the personal property that was in the cell he occupied will be handled by at least three or four different people. And of course, this allows for no one to be held responsible for what is missing or broken. And when you think about the limited amount of property that a death row prisoner has, pictures of loved ones, legal files, music, books, whatever, it's really precious to them. And the way they operate is they force a prisoner to ship the property out of the prison so that they don't have to take responsibility for it. But this is a real hardship for many of these individuals, and they lose control of their property in the process. He also points out that some of the stuff is given to people who squeal. So it's used to reward other prisoners at the expense of the man who was fleeced. He also talks, and this is, you might think, a kind of minor humiliation. But he said, in the whole, prisoners are often not issued even a flimsy plastic spoon or fork. And in these cases, when the food trays are given to the prisoners, they literally eat their food with their hands. Mm-hmm. Which is really a subhuman approach. And he said he's had to do this many times, and that in the adjustment center, they only give them 3 minutes to complete a meal.
Mm.
And after 3 minutes, they take the tray back.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I treat my dog, who's been barking a lot in this interview, better than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, another thing with that, I mean, one of the things that really terrified me in the early months when I was in solitary confinement is one day I found myself eating with my hands. And it was because when you are not being seen, you start to pretty quickly start to become desocialized and apathetic,
mm-hmm.
and act like an animal. I mean, I spent hours and hours just crouched by the slot in my cell door listening for sounds. And I would stop and I would think, look, you know, what do I look like right now? Just like a pacing, you know, maniacal animal, mm-hmm. full of anger. And a lot of the guys and women that I've visited around the country, when you finally sit across from them, whether it's through glass or the one woman I actually got to sit just across from her in a chair, Judith Vasquez, her story in here is unbelievably powerful. They'll just ask you, do I seem normal to you?
Mm.
Am I looking at you normal? Is my eye contact normal? Is my posture normal? They just want some kind of affirmation from the outside,
yeah.
that they're still okay. And of course, they're not okay.
And was it Judith who spent so long in solitary that when they told her she was going to be released, that she resisted because she wasn't sure she could handle it?
She resisted. She was terrified to leave. She said that when they put her out on this, she described it like grounds in a low security facility. And she said she could barely walk because her muscles had atrophied and she'd been just used to walking in such a small space.
Mm-hmm.
She writes about spending time in the hole where she would have these horrific visions of hell opening up, the floor in front of her just opening up, and being completely terrified that she would fall into it. And having a very small window on her door, and she could, it was just a wall, a cement wall, but there was a tiny plant growing out of a crack.
Mm-hmm.
And she would spend all day for weeks and weeks, if not months and months, just bonding with this piece of green. This became the most beautiful, precious thing with a personality, and it loved her and she loved it. And then one day, she just couldn't take it anymore because it was so painful for her to look at this plant because it reminded her so much of everything she'd lost.
Yeah.
And she covered her window up with a plastic bag that she had. And after that, she never looked out the window again because it hurt her even more.
Wow. I'm reminded of Tupac's song about the rose growing out of concrete when you described that.
Mm-hmm.
James Anderson also talks about the unnecessary violence that's visited on solitary prisoners in unneeded cell extractions. And so they'll open the door, and he describes it. He said, if it weren't so serious, it would be amusing. But it's a scene like this. How and why does it require two guards who are 6'3", 270 pounds plus, with baton in one hand, a mace canister in the other, to escort a 5'2", 160-pound prisoner from the cell to the shower?
Hmm.
And these are the kinds of humiliations that are used under the guise of security. And, for example, when I visited James, it's in one of those cages, and they require the prisoner to cuff up before they can be released from the cage. So he has to extend his hands behind his back and through a hole in the cage,
mm-hmm.
where they then put the cuffs on, and then they open the door to let him out.
And usually their feet are cuffed as well, and there's a belly chain that mm-hmm. Connects to the cuffs on your hands and the cuffs in your feet. So you really just shuffle. An important thing to me to stress with this is I don't want to to condescend to, you know, your audience or any audience that's trying to learn more about this horrific practice. Some of these people that end up in solitary confinement, it's 100,000 people in any given day in this country. Some of them are put in there for completely arbitrary reasons, for walking too slowly, for having an extra bag of chips in their cells. Others have done horrific, violent things to other mm-hmm. prisoners. But those people that are violent are being put in conditions that are proven to make them more violent. The being alone for an extended amount of time and the stigma of it, the feeling of being rejected, has been shown through scientific studies to affect the frontal lobe of your brain, mm-hmm. which is the part of your brain that gives you impulse control, that helps you to not resort to violence, to mm-hmm. have that extra second to take a breath and realize that you have other options or that it's not worth it. So we're literally putting people in a condition that incubates the very problem that put some of them in there in the first place.
Right. And there's limited mental health care, if at all, offered particularly to prisoners in long-term solitary.
Mm-hmm. Oh, almost nothing. And when you do have a psychiatrist, they come and they shout at you from the hall, are you okay in there? Are you having suicidal thoughts? I mean, there's some instances where you're allowed to get out and sit in the cage for these therapy sessions. Mm-hmm. People don't trust the therapist. The therapist is part of the administration that put right. them there in the first place.
Yeah. Here's a tune that I found online from a group called Rhyme Asylum, and it's called Solitary Confinement. Let's listen a little.
Therapy confinement, alone in this mental asylum, 3 hour London. Crazy motherfucker named Cyclone from a mad clan of savage insane psychos. Nasty bastard in your local morgue dancing with a frozen corpse just to get the party started. I don't hold microphones, close my eyes and told the mic to float with mind control. Exit earth, climbing lightning bolts. You rappers got no backup light, broken sky remote, destiny, physical form. Chalk outlines of murder scenes minutes before victims are born. Force vivid subliminal thoughts. I strangle my Siamese, swim with the umbilical cord. Bury your head in desert sands. Link words that rhyme on my verse.
So that's quite a rich stream of consciousness. But one of the things that James Anderson also mentioned is the what they call welfare checks. So depending on the institution and the level of punishment that they're trying to impose, they will check on an inmate every 20 minutes, every 30 minutes, or maybe once an hour. And at San Quentin, they have a system where the guard has to both rattle the cell door and they click off on a little digital device that says that they had inspected that cell. And the digital device has a beep. And so every time they come by that cell, they wake up the prisoner.
Mm.
And, you know, there's certainly less intrusive ways to accomplish the same thing. But it seems like this is one of the Guantanamo-style enhanced interrogation techniques that I call torture. That is used on a routine basis
mm-hmm.
on inmates and is just, you know, ruthless in terms of respect for their needs to get a decent night's sleep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're called wellness checks.
Uh-huh.
And they've been going on for a long time, but they've definitely increased since the legal settlement. A lot of the guards, including the guard union, the California Guard Union came out mm-hmm. the next day and said that the settlement is putting them more at risk and putting them in more danger, and that people needed to be, you know, kept in solitary confinement. Not a single person should get out. Mm-hmm. And these wellness checks have increased specifically against a lot of those individuals.
Yeah. Well, I want to reference that your co-editors of the book, Gene Casella and Jim Ridgway, who I know from his time at Mother Jones Magazine, they operate Solitary Watch, and people can go there and get some of the updated information about what's going on and efforts to change the regulations and the policies that, you know, are related to solitary confinement. Overall, are you seeing kind of a light at the end of the solitary tunnel? Are we becoming more aware and in turn more humane? Or in your view, is it just, you know, kind of a little bite off the apple?
Well, there's definitely a shift. There's a shift in, I think, the story around that people have around who gets put in to the deep end of our prison system and why, and a better analysis, more critical analysis of the whole system of mass incarceration. But the actual changes, I mean, on one hand, you can be very optimistic. I think the Marshall Project said last year more legislation has been passed around the country than in the last, than the previous 18 years combined,
mm-hmm.
specifically around solitary confinement. Most of it is geared towards juveniles and right. Mentally ill people.
Mm-hmm. And the president did issue a directive that bans solitary for the handful of juveniles who are in federal custody.
Literally a handful.
Right.
And those things are not, by any stretch of the imagination, you know, devoid of any meaning, because they help shift the prison culture.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to happen before anything else. You can ban solitary confinement and they'll find a way around it. They'll find a way to keep people, or they'll find something worse.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't really imagine what that would be. But until you shift the whole culture around incarceration,
mm-hmm.
There's going to be abuse and torture and brutality in our prisons.
Yeah.
So these things are significant, but it really is, as far as the numbers are concerned, just a tiny drop in an ocean.
Mm-hmm. Now, Sarah, you've been working on a play, right? About your experiences?
My play is, it's called The Box, and mm-hmm. it's a fictionalized, it's a lot of this, it was inspired by a lot of the same stories that ended up in this book.
Mm-hmm.
That I gathered around the country and interviews that I did over a series of years. And I wove them together into these hybrid characters. It's a story of resistance inside a solitary confinement pod in a U.S. prison.
Mm-hmm. And what's the status of it? I think this fall is when you plan to debut it, right?
July. Yeah, July 8th is the world premiere at Z-Space. And
uh-huh.
Michael Garces of the Cornerstone Theater is directing. We have a phenomenal cast, amazing actors, amazing designers. It's going to be amazing.
All right. Well, I can't wait to see that. I hope that it's a big success.
Thank you.
Sarah Shord, I want to thank you for this important book, Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement.
Thank you, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this conversation with Sarah Shord. I welcome your comments. You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.